Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, from May the 6th, 2017. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the four levels of meditative absorption known as jhanas. A related article is on the website. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. Thank you. Peace. So I mentioned the jhanas. Jhanas is J-H-A-N-A-S last week, and I talk about them often there. The jhanas refer to four levels of meditative absorption that are basically ordinary occurrences during meditation. They've taken on mystical connotations, and even the first jhana is often portrayed as something that is nearly unattainable to most average meditators. And the Buddha never taught that. They're simply things to recognize in meditation practice to show that our meditation practice is bearing fruit. And that's the important thing about them. From the Samyutta Nikaya, the Buddha describes the levels of meditative absorption developed with Shamatha Vipassana meditation. Samadhi, which is usually translated to mean concentration, which is a good translation of it, a more accurate is a non-distracted state, because that's what we're hoping to develop with meditation. That's the primary purpose. I keep saying it over and over again. Primary reason why we meditate within the framework of the Eightfold Path is to develop concentration. And then everything is, it's that deepening concentration that the entire Eightfold Path is able to be developed from. The Buddha's words, from the first jhana. The first jhana is remaining free of distraction by sensuality and sense contact, remaining free of distraction by unskillful mental qualities, and turn remaining in the first jhana. And the qualities are rapture and pleasure born from that concentration, from samadhi, accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. And evaluation refers to insight. So does that make sense to everyone? Perfectly clear. A lot of words to really just say we're starting to meditate, where our minds are starting to come. We're directing our thoughts in a direct way. We're taking control of the way we think. We're developing concentration. That's the first jhana. And the first action we do when we begin our meditation session is to become mindful of the breath. We're directing our thoughts towards our breath, and we're using the breath as our point of focus. That's the first jhana. We do it every time we meditate. We are entering in the first jhana, at least as far as the Buddha taught. The Buddha continues, with a tranquil mind, entering and remaining in the second jhana, rapture and pleasure born of samadhi, of deepening concentration, unification of awareness free from directed thought and evaluation, resting in internal assurance, with the fading of rapture, remaining equanimous, mindful and alert, gaining pleasure with the sensation of breathing in the body. So again, a lot of words to say that we're just deepening our concentration, and now we've all had the experience when he's... Let me go back to his words so I don't mischaracterize it. Free from directed thought and evaluation. That's just that experience that, for the moment at least, I'm no longer focused on my breath, but I'm also not distracted by my thoughts. And that's a level of concentration that we can deepen. Am I clear about that too? Have you all had that experience? Or at least, I know you have, but have you recognized the experience? Pardon me?
Split second.
Yeah, of course it's important to develop that, but as far as it relates to what the Buddha's talking about, that split second is the second jhana. And the reason why the Buddha taught these is simply to recognize that. It's important to say, yes, this is bearing fruit. I am deepening my concentration. For a split second, I wasn't thinking about the story of my life, and I also wasn't completely focused on my breath. My mind was concentrated for that split second.
Does directed evaluation mean that you're recognizing your thinking?
In the context of the jhanas, it really is that you're no longer directing your thought towards your breath. You are simply well concentrated in that moment. So again,
so you're in your breath.
It's maybe a better way of saying it. And when the Buddha's talking about evaluation here, he's not talking about analyzing what's occurring or even analyzing the sensation of your breath. It's simply being mindful of what's occurring. It's not an analytical evaluation. Okay. It's really simply being mindful in this sense. And then the insight, in fact, the word the Buddha uses is not insight, it's evaluation. But it is insight into the three marks of existence that we're hoping to develop in our general practice, but not necessarily as part of a meditation session. Is that clear? Meditation is primarily for deepening concentration. And in this context, noticing the deepening concentration through these four levels of absorption.
The pleasure and the rapture part is like confusing me.
Because of the words.
Yeah.
For one thing, rapture.
And even the word seeking, I feel like it's...
Rapture...
I don't want to split hairs, but it's just like when you're saying it, I'm like getting confused.
No, I know, and even in writing, and this happens to me a lot when I'm taking the direct translation of the Pali and trying to present it in a way that makes sense, mm-hmm. and using some of these words. So rapture is probably one of the most misunderstood words in the human language. We think that it's, I don't even know what we think, and all kinds of feelings seems to come up around rapture, like it's some... I don't know, just incredibly
intense.
Miraculous experience.
Intense.
When really
intense.
Yeah. It really means to be in awe of something. But even remember in the Dhamma, using it that way can create specialness. So a better way of saying rapture is just a very mindful presence of what's occurring. And the pleasure that we're talking about is not sensory pleasure, but the pleasure of simply meditating. The joy of the practice itself. So
I don't think we could continue meditating if we didn't feel that. I think that's kind of part of it, even though we may not be aware of it, because there is some reward that, you know, because we do struggle with our thoughts and all that, but there's also this other sensation, I don't know.
Yeah.
Activity that is somewhat
somehow
rewarding that even if you do 2 minutes or 5 minutes, you still
want to
continue doing it.
And Eva, that's exactly why the Buddha even is talking about jhanas, just to give us something to recognize it. Yeah, this is really working, and we can increase our pleasure over that. But this is something that's bearing fruit, and I can recognize it within my meditation session. Again, most of the benefits of meditation are realized off our cushions, aren't they? In our day-to-day, moment-by-moment life, we realize that we're more present, we're more calm, we're more mindful. But on our cushions, we can use this explanation of these different levels of meditative absorption to check ourselves and to show, yeah, this is really working. I do notice that for a split second, I don't have to direct my thoughts, and yet I'm still well-focused. And now we'll get into the deeper levels. And again, as I'm reading this, just try to relate it to your own meditation sessions and that you're actually experiencing this. Gotta find my place again. The Buddha continues, enter and remaining in the third jhana, which is equanimous and mindful, a pleasant abiding. So there's not a lot of description there. We've gone from no level of meditative absorption. We're walking into our meditation room, and we sit down, and we start focusing on our breath. We're directing our thoughts, and our mind begins to quiet by that simple action. And then as our concentration deepens and we continue our meditation session, even for a split second or maybe for a few good moments, there is no directed thought. We're not even thinking of our breath for a few moments. And we're not caught up in the story of our life. Now, that third level, equanimous means a measure of equanimity. Our minds are simply at peace and at rest. There's no disturbance in the mind at all. That's what equanimous means, or a mind of equanimity. And that also relates to the fourth jhana. But the important thing here is to recognize that we are now entering into a deeper level of concentration that we can put a label on called equanimity. It's just it's an extended period, and again extended, I mean it might be just 2 split seconds rather than 1 of non-directed calm. the Buddha continues, abandoning pleasure and pain, meaning now the essence of the Dhamma is to recognize and abandon craving and clinging, which is also an aspect of dukkha, which is also an aspect of pleasure and pain. In our meditation sessions, as we deepen our concentration, we're having a direct experience of what a fully awake and fully mature mind is. Abandoning pleasure and pain. We're no longer have no any agitation in our minds because we have let go of all craving and clinging. And in our meditation sessions, we have experiences of that. Abandoning pleasure and pain due to the renunciation of pleasure and pain, entering and remaining in the fourth jhana, purity of equanimity and mindfulness, neither pleasure nor pain. So we've entered a state now where we're not even thinking of, wow, I feel great, or wow, for this brief moment there's no pain, and pain, not just physical pain or emotional pain, any agitation in our minds. We've gone past even the recognition of that, and we're just resting in a non-discriminating mind. And again, it might be just for a brief moment, but if you're mindful of your meditation sessions, and again, this is really why I'm teaching it and why the Buddha taught it, you'll recognize that you've had even a brief split-second experience of that, that deep level of concentration, where there's no discriminating thought. There's no, I like this, I don't like that. There's no, this is the most wonderful meditation I've ever had, or it's the worst. You're resting in equanimity. So, my words, the jhanas are not to be taken as mind states to achieve. And the reason why I say that is they're often portrayed that way, but there's every one of us that starts a meditation practice, myself included, can't help but look at it as there's something to achieve here beyond just concentration. That we want to have good feelings, or we want to have, when I first started meditation, I was really intent on having, it's a shame to say it, having mystical experiences or finding ways to travel in my astral body and all kinds of silly stuff. But it's often taught that those are things to achieve too. Or to have this experience of nothingness, which is something that the Buddha was taught early on and rejected them too. These different planes of existence of neither perception nor non-perception. Those are all conceptual planes that we can set up as something to achieve in meditation rather than what the Buddha is teaching. Just these four levels of meditative absorption, and notice when you've achieved it, even if it's just for a brief moment. The jhanas are simply an explanation of different levels of concentration. Much is made in the modern Buddhist commentaries regarding the importance of achieving these states and the intense effort needed to reach the more advanced levels. There is no relative importance to any of these states except to point to the experience of deepening concentration. The Buddha explained these states to specifically downplay any sense of special achievements associated with the jhanas or any special achievements in our meditation, save for deepening concentration. They are simply states of mindfulness, of deepening concentration, that are common experiences to all who engage in wholehearted development of the Eightfold Path. All that is needed to experience these levels of concentration and absorption is Dhamma practice within that path. In the Salaka Sutta, the Buddha points to Mahakunda, one of the senior monks, that he may have been placing too much emphasis on the levels of meditative absorption. In this sutta, this is a brief one, Kunda asked the Buddha if acquiring the absorption of the jhanas would bring final release. So again, he's looking for achievement through just a meditation practice. If I can just keep getting deeper and deeper into this, that's going to be the answer. The Buddha places the importance of the jhanas as a foundational aspect of the Dhamma, and then describes the right discipline developed by the Eightfold Path as the way to develop complete release. The Buddha's words. In the Noble One's discipline, it is not these attainments that are called ending clinging. In the Noble One's discipline, they are simply called peaceful abidings. Again, something to recognize. There are achievements in our meditation practice, but they're not something to chase after. They're just peaceful levels of absorption, they're peaceful abiding. In the Noble One's discipline, it is not these attainments that are called ending clinging. I read it again. Called ending clinging. In the Noble One's discipline, they are called peaceful abidings. But here, Kunda, is how ending clinging should be developed. And notice the practicality of what he's saying. He's speaking to the hindrances and he's speaking to the Eightfold Path. Remain harmless. Abstain from killing living beings. Abstain from taking what is not given. abstain from sexual misconduct, abstain from false speech, abstain from hurtful speech, abstain from gossip, abandon ill will, abandon wrong view, and develop right view. Abandon wrong intention and develop right intention. Abandon wrong speech and develop right speech. Abandon wrong actions and develop right action. Abandon wrong livelihood and develop right livelihood. Abandon wrong mindfulness and develop right mindfulness. Abandon wrong concentration and develop right concentration. So the Buddha is taking Kunda, who's, you can imagine Kunda is kind of enamored with his meditative achievements and thinking that that is the end all. And the Buddha is bringing him back to earth and saying, you need to be mindful of the hindrances. You need to be mindful of the Eightfold Path to guide your behavior. It is not meditation alone. Again, the Buddha is speaking, teaching this in a very direct way. You can't do it with just meditation. You have to develop the Eightfold Path. In this way, release from clinging can be accomplished. And that's from the Majjhima Nikaya. In other words, the actual path the Buddha taught is what many modern Buddhists would consider the more mundane, even archaic aspects of the Eightfold Path, and overemphasize meditative achievement and mystical insight. I just finished rewriting a very long article on the Pali Canon. It's on the website now, and it's also included in the new book. And one of the reasons why I rewrote it and put a lot more material in there is because going all the way back to the Second Council, which was 125 years after the Buddha's death, there was the beginning of the diminishing of the Buddha's teaching in favor of later developed teachings. And over time, and included in many, many modern Buddhist traditions, the Buddha's simple and direct teachings on the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path are diminished in importance or dismissed completely as they're just archaic and preliminary teachings. And in the article, I really get into where that specifically, there's been specific actions and sutras developed to specifically downplay what the Buddha taught as his Dhamma, as the Eightfold Path. And again, I'm not putting, this is simply what's occurred. And you can see in this sutta, the Buddha's saying, he's almost warning against it. Kunda wanted to do that. Kunda wanted to start establishing a mystical kind of practice based solely on meditation and what might arise. And the Buddha's saying, you're missing the whole point. It's not meditation. It's this path that you develop. I'm just going to cite another sutta real quick just to conclude this. In the Panchakanda Sutta, the Buddha teaches that jhanas, meditative absorption, is initiated with mindfulness. The Buddha's words, even in a confining place, meaning an unawakened mind, a mind that is stuck with one thought following another thought, a mind that's stuck in clinging thoughts, even in a confining place, it is found the Dhamma. It is found that the Dhamma is for attainment of unbinding. Those who have gained proper refined mindfulness are rightly well focused to experience jhana. So the Buddha is saying it, if you want to experience these jhanas, it's not to chase after them, it's to develop the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. That's how we deepen everything in our lives. That's how we have a deeper experience on our cushion, and of course a practical experience of awakening off our cushion. So then, just to reiterate the point, the jhanas are not something to chase after, they're just simply something to recognize, to show ourselves the efficacy of our own meditation practice, that we're actually deepening these levels. So that's the end of our talk today. Thank you. Any questions directly on the talk?
And we'll... Yes. So you're saying the two important ingredients are meditation and the teachings, correct?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, so, but is there a connection between achieving higher jhanas and staying in jhanas longer and enlightenment, whatever that means?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the progression towards awakening. So, as our practice deepens, as we deepen our entire Eightfold Path practice, meditation being one factor, being mindful of the jhanas, and we could just use it, it might be better for us in the West to just say different levels of meditative absorption, because jhanas has a little, you know, it's not a familiar word, to recognize that there are four general levels that we can recognize of meditative absorption that develops as our entire practice develops. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. Because I think the more you meditate, the more likely it is you're going to hit a higher level and stay there longer.
Yes, but remember the Buddha's teaching, an awakened human being, saying it's not, he's telling Kunda here, it's not just meditation. If you want to reach
right.
those other levels and actually sustain the other levels, you need to have an eightfold path, because it's not just in our minds that we achieve awakening. It's in our minds that we recognize what we've developed that is blocking us. And that's what that's the point of recognition and renunciation. That's the real point of mindfulness.
So like, could we look at it as the better you can deepen your meditation, the more likely it is that you'll have the ability to gain insight through the teachings to become more awake?
I would put it this way. I would say that the you can deepen your concentration by including your meditation practice as part of the Eightfold Path, rather than, and again, this is.
Could you say that again?
We can deepen our concentration by including the entire Eightfold Path as part of our practice, rather than relying too much on meditation alone, and maybe giving a cursory glance at the rest of it, or putting a little bit of effort in looking at our speech.
After all, in his listing of the Eightfold Path, the meditation is at the end part. He focuses on the meditation part at the end of those eightfold path, sort of. And so, sort of indicating that the right speech or the right intention are the more beginning.
Exactly. Again, meditation is primarily for deepening concentration. Why? So from that well-concentrated or increasingly well-concentrated mind, we're able to hold in mind the other factors of the Eightfold Path. So it is one cohesive path. It's not just meditation. And if we rely on, and I've seen this so often, and I've had my own experience, if we rely just on meditation, what that will do is simply reinforce conditioned thinking, because we have no frame of reference to even recognize conditioned thinking. That's the main reason why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path and not just meditation.
Yeah, plus you would be more distracted because your viewpoints would be hurting you while you're trying to meditate.
Or you wouldn't even notice it, because you can create a scenario in your own mind where you're not recognizing it, because you're not facing it, and you think that you're doing something that is inherently useful. The best example I have of that, but there's a lot of them, and I know I've talked about this. I got a call, this is probably 2 years ago now, from a gentleman I never met, but I thought I would. But he heard about me, and over the phone, I could tell immediately he was agitated. He gave me said how he called me, how he found out about me. He told me a story. He says, I'm 38 years old. He says, I'm living the American dream. I got lived in Newtown. I got a beautiful house, beautiful wife, 3 kids, 2 cars, blah, blah, blah. Everything's going wonderful. And he said, I feel like I have nothing in my life. And as soon as he said that, I had an idea of where he was going. And he said, and I've been meditating for 20 years. And I'm not going to say the tradition, but anybody who listens to what I'm going to say will figure it out. And I says, well, tell me about your meditation practice. He says, well, for 20 years, my meditation practice is to develop nothingness, to develop that. And I said, will you tell me to say that again? I said, well, my meditation practice is focusing on developing the sensation of nothingness, or the understanding of nothingness. And over the phone, I could hear the light going off in his head. He said, holy, for 20 years I've been focusing on nothingness, and that's exactly what I'm feeling. He got it. I didn't have to give him any other explanation. What good was it? Was, again, 20 years of intense meditation every day in a certain tradition, trying to develop the experience of nothingness, and that's exactly what he developed. And talk about an agitated mind, I could feel it through the phone. So he didn't develop in his mind, and we had a long conversation. He says, you know, I felt that every one of my meditation sessions was wonderful all these years. In his mind, he believed that he was achieving something that was valuable. Because of the method was an incorrect method, lacking the entire framework, he was able to further condition his mind to the point where he was really deluding himself into almost a psychotic state, meaning psychosis, believing that everything was wonderful when it was actually awful in his own mind. So that it makes the point of that. Without the proper framework, and I've seen it for so many people. It was my own experience going back many, many years was just that. I was getting, I don't want to say psychotic because I never got really to that point. I was developing beliefs that were completely delusional, and I attributed them to my meditation practice because I was having certain experiences that at the time I didn't realize that I was creating the experience in my own mind and using the experience to validate my intention. Really? But I didn't realize it at the time. But it's a pretty dangerous place to be in, because then from that point, I mean, I remember I still remember some of the thoughts that I had. I was really living a deluded quality of life, because I thought at that point that whatever I think about, I was going to manifest in my life. It was going to magically appear. And that happened enough to keep validating it. When the, most of the time that it didn't, I just ignored the fact that it, 99.9% of the time I was fooling myself. That 0.1% was, wow, everything's working. I think about, boy, I'd just like to have a nice rose growing tomorrow, and there it is, it happened to grow. I forget all about that. I planted the seed and I watered it for 6 months, and all, it didn't come out of my mind, it came out of my, But that's what happens. It's so easy to get caught up. And then it's to bring this back to kind of just the normal conditioned thinking. That's exactly what we do. That's the problem of conditioned thinking. Yeah. Bringing it back to the jhana. It's a great question. Bringing it back to the jhanas again. Simply recognize that meditation is having an effect. So, any other questions or comments on that?
So just based on the kind of conversation that both of you just had, I just wanted to kind of 3-2-1 review. The jhanas are sort of like mind states.
Yep.
That, so to me, it's not really something you compartmentalize on the cushion, off the cushion. It's just mind states that are fluid, right?
Yep. Impermanent.
But also they're not just only on the cushion or only. It's either, it's all, you could have the mind states on and off and awakening, even though I realize that I'm speaking from a non-awakened mind, so it's probably not quite right, but...
Well, I'll wait till after the retreat.
It's
off.
The fourth jhana is kind of, if you're always there, that's kind of awakened.
Well, yeah, this does relate to what Anthony was talking about, too. An awakened mind is a mind that rests in equanimity.
Right.
But it can create a little grasping if we look at the fourth jhana as that, because that's really not what the Buddha is saying. It's just simply, it is something that we experience in meditation. As we deepen our practice, our whole practice, we'll have a mind that does rest in equanimity for longer periods of time until the point when we let go of all deluded views, all conditioned thinking. And at that point, again, this is how the Buddha described awakening, nothing magical or mystical or esoteric. At that point, we've developed our concentration and mindfulness enough that we will no longer get stuck in the world. There's no opportunity for agitation to arise or distraction to arise. Because we've created the conditions in our own mind to not become attached to what's occurring, to not reacting to what's occurring.
Mm-hmm.
To some people, that sounds like not even a worthwhile goal. Like, so what? But that's the whole point. At least it's the whole point of the Buddha's Dhamma. Everything we do in our life, whether it's misdirected or directed towards awakening, is to develop a calm and peaceful state. The problem with a conditioned mind is we don't understand how to do that. We think we can do it by acquisition, by creating the outward scenario of safety and, abundance, when all of that is temporary. But we can create a mind that understands the outer process of human life and remain at peace with what occurs. It doesn't mean we won't get up Monday morning and go to work, but we'll do it with a much more mindful presence. It doesn't mean that we won't continue to meditate. I got a great question a couple months ago from a student I'd never asked before. I never even thought about it. He says, why does the Buddha continue to meditate after he awakened?
To stay awakened.
Why not?
Well, and why wouldn't he? Why, you know, it's not because he needs to, but we should look at our own meditation as we need to, except we want to use it to awaken. It's a pleasant abiding. It's a true, even for someone who is awakened, such as the Buddha, but all the other thousands that awakened during his teaching. Why wouldn't you want to just go sit quietly and be mindful of your breath to appreciate that mind of equanimity?
Especially in this day and age, this is so contrary to what everybody's taught. You gotta go for a life, you gotta grasp the, you know, you're gonna miss the book.
Yeah.
You know, listen to every commercial and buy every item that's on there and live every second with gusto.
Yeah, isn't it? And that's exactly how it's sold, isn't it? Really, I mean, so many people have. All of us at one point, we thought we couldn't give a minute to meditation because we're just so busy. But it's because of that. It's because we're so indoctrinated in thinking that every minute we have to be getting something or experiencing something. Why? What are we doing? You know, I remember having those thoughts even, you know, when I was really young. I didn't have any context to understand it. But the whole idea, I was talking about mirror this one, I'm thinking about this now. I was talking about this to a student the other day. Even at like 14, 15, 16 years old, the whole idea of the direction of my life didn't seem to make sense, but I didn't understand it. I thought I was just rebellious, like, you know, thinking about the whole thing, just, you know, going to school, good grades, do this, get to college, etc. What's the point of it all? I mean, where is it leading me? I didn't understand it. Well, there's a mundane aspect of, it's a good thing to get a good education and, you know, if you can go to college, that's great, and all that—that's important part of. But when you create identities out of it, and if they don't happen or they create stress in your life, you're missing the whole point. You're not living your life. So, and again, bringing it back to the jhanas, they're just here to emphasize the point that meditation is for deepening concentration within that broader framework. And again, I keep going. That was a great question. It's a really insightful question that you asked. Anything else to say before? Let's go around the room for him. That's what I was saying.
Well, I'm going to wait.
Your turn.
I've talked too much already. But no, I just wanted to say that if I'm going to be honest about it, I do meditate a lot because I like the way it makes me feel. Like I want to hit that high jhana. And in the middle of a 10-day silent retreat and we were meditating all day, I hit a jhana so high that it felt like I was on that gas the dentist put you on.
Mm-hmm.
Like it was that pleasurable.
Yeah.
I actually felt like I was going to explode.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't know what that is, and I've never had it again. But
well, it's an impermanent experience, but it arises. Everything that occurs, this is something else it's important to understand. What it was an expression of your own mind and body. There was nothing mystical about it, but it was a deep level of meditative absorption. It's important to be mindful of it, that this is what occurs. But of course, think about this, it's not something that is practically useful because you couldn't live in the world in that state of mind. You know, it's good to have the experience. But how practically useful is it? Because remember, it's not, we can't live on our cushions. The Buddha didn't teach that we should live on our cushions. What we develop on our cushions has to be integrated into the Eightfold Path, and that Eightfold Path is integrated into our life. And that's what's most important.
And then the Buddha says also that we're not supposed to cling to that.
Yeah.
We're just clinging to a whole other thing again.
That's exactly right. Yeah. That's why he's teaching the jhanas. Whatever arises in meditation is to be the greatest insight is to recognize that all of these states, exalted or completely miserable, are all temporary. They're all everything is temporary, and it's not to diminish anything, but it's not to diminish the miserableness in other words, in a way, to ignore it or to think, you know, get into this positive thinking. It's simply to recognize this is what's occurred. Even a powerful experience like you had, it's temporary. Don't hold on to it. I mean, that's the real point. Debbie, I know you have to go, so I'm going to call on you next. Yeah. So what would you like to say?
Well, first of all, I never heard this teaching before, so I was really glad to hear it, and I feel like I had a whole misunderstanding about the insight meditation, because not about on off the cushion, but about the levels, because I feel like I have had that experience at different levels, but that when I did, I felt like I was doing it wrong, because I'm supposed to keep focusing on the breath.
Oh,
just go to deeper concentration without focusing on the breath. So it's so interesting that, you know, if I did that, I was like, oh, I'm doing this wrong. I go back and focus on breath, even though that was a pleasurable state. You know, so
good job you came today.
Yeah, and I'm like, good. Anyway, so I've never heard this. So it's something that's always happened in my meditation, that I felt like there was different levels, but you know, in this teaching and coming to this Sangha and this Dhamma, I thought that was not the way to get it, right? So, interesting.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you're here today, too, because, yeah, it is important to recognize these different levels, and it's important to take real pleasure in our meditation practice, not a clingy-type pleasure.
Yeah.
I mean, as part of the Eightfold Path, you could use the word miraculous, but there's no such thing. It's the most important thing that I've ever done in my life. You know, it really is. And it's something that I can do. It doesn't matter, no matter what conditions are going on in the world, whether it's global or immediate, it's something I can always do. And I look forward to it because it's so pleasurable. You know, but not in a clingy way. It's just wonderful. And Debbie, yeah, it's so important to recognize that you're able to achieve these in a almost a matter of fact way. They just occur, and that's exactly what the Buddha's teaching here. They're not something to chase after, but it's important to recognize it. Yeah.
And they're very
great. Yeah.
But even
that is important. That's important insight, because you're learning about impermanence.
Yes.
Every quality of our mind is impermanent until we get to that level of awakening where our mind is resting in equanimity. But even that doesn't mean that we won't have human feelings. They'll simply be appropriate to what's occurring. You know,
I think sometimes I have it more of that experience off the cushion, actually, when I am in a stressful situation and I just go to my breath and focus. Sometimes I feel like it just takes me to that concentrated place of peace. And that is more than just focusing on the breath. So that's a very, very helpful tool in my life.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and again, that's the result of incorporating the entire Eightfold Path into your life and having that developing overarching right view, you know, just seeing things clearly. And think about how that it's such a powerful and important teaching that develops, but it's so simple in application. You realize that you're just caught up in what's going on. Take a moment and be mindful of my breath. And it changes everything. Why? Because it brings you now mindfully into your life as your life is occurring, rather than reacting to something
right.
that even
takes me out of the ego.
Yeah.
A lot of my stress is when I'm in the ego, mm-hmm. and back into that peaceful place.
Yeah. And again, you're describing the practical experience of recognizing anatta, the not self characteristic, the self referential ego self that is prone to dukkha, prone to stress and suffering, and withdrawing yourself from that. That's true restraint. It's just a practical explanation of how the teachings work. So,
renunciation.
Yeah.
And renunciation. Oh. You know, we think, oh, renunciation, you know, it's a bad thing, you know.
It sounds old. I don't want to give up anything.
But it's a little subtle thing like that, just to
finish it. It's interesting you brought that up. the word is a difficult word for people to accept, but it really is that. The ego doesn't, anatta, the five clinging aggregates, it doesn't want to let go of anything, even something that is hurtful. I don't want to renounce it because I've created an identity, or it's part of me. I feel like you're giving up a limb to give up something that's hurtful. But yet, it frees you. And all you have to do, all you got to do is come back to the sensation of breathing. But with the right view that's developed through the Eightfold Path, you know, and you realize you're not giving up anything that's worthwhile. You're just giving up basically a deluded view, rooted in ignorance of the Four Noble Truths, the origination. Jen, anything else?
I had this experience this past weekend that I just feel like sharing. I went to the Shad Festival, which I've lived in Lambertville for New Hope area for 15 years, and every year going to the Shad Festival was this event of, you know, being able to kind of show off and be the most amazing local and the best musician and most amazingly dressed and the one that knows the most people. And I haven't gone to Shad Fest in maybe a year or two. I just haven't made it there, and I went there just to kind of walk around, and my experience was so different than it had been in the past that I was actually like, by the time I left, I felt like kind of weird, like just like what that was strange. Like I felt like I couldn't talk to people, and I just felt different. And then after, as I was kind of like leaving and walking home, I realized, oh, you're just not managing. You're not always like trying to be something or trying to manage other people's view of you. Yeah. You just don't care.
That's incredible.
Every person that I ran into, it was a conversation. Sometimes it was a little strange because I just kind of, I didn't get the surge of whatever I was getting in the past, but that's because I wasn't seeking it. And so that's why it felt strange and different. I mean, it wasn't bad at all. It was better.
Yeah.
It was definitely much simpler. And was something else to realize how much time and energy I was spending on. I mean, it was all consuming.
In the past.
In the past.
Yeah.
To be Jenny Rose. You know? So, I mean, it was all consuming. All of my time went to trying to be this person.
And you're describing a very stressful state around
yeah.
What could be a very pleasant event.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. That's just great insight.
Yeah.
I mean, I know you know what that is. That's the exact same event. You had two completely distinct experiences of it. One was stressful that you didn't even recognize, and one was peaceful,
mm-hmm.
and probably ultimately more pleasant too.
Yeah.
Definitely
same more event. I was more just more present.
Yeah.
Really seeing what was happening rather than chasing the most amazing experience. I went there for like a couple hours, and I was like, okay, I'm good. I'm gonna go home now. But whereas before it was like, oh, I just did the last possible
thing. This was the best Shad Fest I was ever at.
It's just, anyway.
Yeah, that's great, Thank you. The Dhamma at work.
Were you ever the queen of the Shad Fest?
Right? Mm-hmm. Is that even a thing? I don't think so.
Anyway. It's amazing how that ego drives
it. I felt like I had to confess that for some reason.
Thank you.
Completely let it go.
Well, it's you describe perfectly a self-referential ego self,
yeah.
and the cessation of that, mm-hmm. through the Dhamma.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing. Eva, good to see you this morning.
Good to be here.
How's your jhana?
Your
Yeah, I like that, Jen, that I manage how, you know, people's idea or impressions of myself.
Yeah.
That's really a lot of what goes on in our lives. Just happy to be here, and I've learned very much. Thank you.
I'm glad you're here this morning. Debbie, do you have anything else to add? I'm glad you're here. Lorna, good to see you this morning.
Good to be here. Thank you, John. A very interesting talk. I have experience and can recall a lot of what you were talking about. So that's good.
Yeah.
As far as my own practice, sort of just like what's being aired in the room, I also feel that when I go into situations that are busy or stimulating, or you know, I'm just not as stimulated, or I'm not and sometimes I just want to withdraw from it, you know, it's just not what it used to be. It's changed. As far as sort of thinking about your meditation practice on the cushion and then off your cushion, I often, or sometimes, think of my thoughts as entanglements.
Okay.
Entanglements, I like that word. I think it describes what an entanglement is. It's everything.
Yep.
It's all your thoughts, really. But you can right, look at your thoughts. This is an entanglement. You know,
okay.
It's just a story. Just drop it and come back to your breath. Just recognize it as an entanglement. So I like that word, and I often sort of think that word comes to mind, you know, several times a day, you know, when I'm sort of really trying to be mindful. So I think that's helpful. And just what Eva said earlier about, you know, you're supposed to be, you know, always wanting and purchasing and needing something or anything like that. There's a presenter on TV that I sometimes watch, and his saying is, never be satisfied. Never be satisfied with life. Always like want to strive and want to go, which is what Eva was just saying, really. And I've often thought, if you try never to be satisfied, you're never satisfied.
That's right. That's the essence
like
of dukkha.
Something at the team. You know, just wake up. If that's even what you're thinking about, you're never going to be satisfied.
Yeah.
And you're always going to be stressed, you know, wanting and needing and desiring and all the other stuff. So that kind of comes into my life sometimes. So I see bits of things like that in my life. I know I've just aired a lot of views in a different way of what other people have said, but you know, it's kind of all the same thing, I think, in my life.
Yes, it is kind of the same thing that we're all talking about, and that's remarkable. We're all talking about applying the Eightfold Path in a practical way and reaping the practical benefits of it. That's what the Buddha taught. That's how it, and that's why he taught it. To change the way we think and change the way we live our lives moment by moment. To live them mindfully with what's occurring rather than reacting to what's happening and needing things to be different. And so when you, I'm going to let you talk in a minute, but I got to talk first because I got to see. You were talking about having a less reactive mind. You weren't, I can't remember the word that you use, excited over things occurring. But your life has become more enjoyable because of that, hasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
And a lot of what comes up when people first encounter this, and even sometimes as they start developing it, what's going to happen when I don't have that excitement in my life anymore? What happens when I'm not passionate about things? You enjoy your life a lot more because you're able to actually experience what's occurring without, when you're stuck in that need for constant satisfaction, no matter what happens, you get the biggest piece of chocolate cake and it's not enough. You got to have a bigger one tomorrow. You can never satisfy an ego. You can't. It's impossible. But when you look at life realistically, you remain satisfied all the time because you don't need it to be any different. Dukkha, the word dukkha, means an ongoing unsatisfactory experience in life because we're always chasing after what makes me satisfied. When we realize that nothing can make you satisfied from an ego standpoint, you're always satisfied. You're always at peace. And then you can even enjoy, or at least have a pleasant, that's the wrong word, you can have a mindful experience of things that are unpleasant because you realize that they're temporary too. It's simply part of life. You were going to say something.
Yeah, just something sprung to mind. There's been one, you know, things have been difficult at home, just like... there's been one or two nights where I've laid in bed and had a bad night, what you call it, you know, had a bad night, I was thinking of this, thinking of that, you know, till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, whatever, just going over and over and over. Does that kind of happen at night because there's no distractions around you?
It's more likely to.
Because in the daytime, if you get into that sort of a negative stream of thought, there's always something going to come the next minute or the next 5 minutes, and it's distracting you from your own thoughts. But when you're laid in bed at night and it's dark, there's nothing, and it just goes, it just perpetually goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
And is that, it happens at night because there's no distractions to distract you from it, is that right?
Yeah, I would say so. That's, you know, and that's the reason why when we're not in bed during the day, we're constantly looking for distractions. And it's really one after another. You know. The people would probably dispute this, but the people that have gotten extremely, ridiculously wealthy in the last 10 or 15 years have done it because they found the most distracting way to promote distraction.
Yeah.
Facebook. You know, Twitter. I mean, really, they're multi-zillionaires because they found a way to keep people constantly distracted. You know, Google search. Imagine it, the money that, I mean, it's a ridiculous amount of money that a few people made because they figured out how much we want to find other things to keep us distracted. Google search. You know? And not, I mean, again, I'm not putting any of them down, but good for them.
I'll spend more time thinking about some celebrity's life than my own.
Right? Yeah.
Like,
yep.
What am I thinking about here? Yeah. Just like,
if you,
we can find out what happened next.
But we've always been like that, you know. In the 30s and 40s, my grandparents put their pennies together so they could go get distracted at the movie theater. Again, it wasn't wrong, but they put their last pennies together for 2 hours of distraction watching Buster Keaton, whoever. And again, not wrong. It's what we do. It's human nature. So, that'd be good to see you.
Good to see
you next. Oh, I want no class next week. We'll be on retreat. So I'll see you in a couple weeks. Any other comments, questions? Great talk. We'll finish with the Buddha's words on metta. Again, no class next Thursday or Saturday. But we'll be back the week after. So find your relaxed meditative posture, gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk today. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace. Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.